I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. It was Dalton Kemp who said that because of my guest now, people read their issues of Maclean's magazine from back to front. For 27 years, from 1976 to 2003, Alan Fotheringham was the back page columnist, skewering as he did and shining a light on the politics and culture of this country in his winning and witty way. Before that, he was a longtime columnist in the Vancouver Sun and in a number of Southern papers, and he's also appeared regularly in the Toronto Sun, the Globe and Mail, and the National Post. He's the author of 8 previous books, and he's just come out with his memoirs, Boy from Nowhere, A Life in 91 Countries. He was born in Hearne, Saskatchewan, nearly 80 years ago, a town so small, he writes, that they didn't have a village idiot. Everyone took turns. He's lived in Toronto for more than 30 years or more, where he joins me from this morning, but he's identified as from these parts, being from Vancouver, from British Columbia. I grew up reading Fotheringham in high school in the mid to late 90s, idolizing his style on the page and off. I don't dress as well, and I don't write anymore, because he does both seemingly so well and so effortlessly, it's mind-boggling. This new book is a wonderful reminder of what a terrific writer Alan Fotheringham has been for well over 50 years and how much he's missed from the regular pages of our press. We'll discuss this charming book and this charmed life and career, the recent medical disaster in his life, and how he views the country today. I'll also get him to remember some giants in this country, namely Jack Webster and Marjorie Nichols. The book is published by Dundurn. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Planta Online program Alan Fotheringham. Good morning, Mr. Fotheringham.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So the medical situation, that was in 2007, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what happened there?
Well, the biggest medical malpractice of of history, I went in just for a routine 48-hour yearly inspection, and somehow somebody pushed the wrong button, and you cannot believe it, and I hope it doesn't ruin your lunch, but they took the remains of my bowels and put them in my lungs, if you can figure that out,
yeah.
And I went, as a result, I went into the hospital weighing 170 pounds, and 5 months later, I came out weighing 115 pounds, thanks to medical malpractice of some jerk who pushed the wrong button. So it wasn't a pleasant year, as you can imagine. I was going to heaven, and the hospital asked my wife to write out an obituary for the Globe and Mail, which she refused. My 3 children flew in from Vancouver to listen to the last rites, and I was so heavily drugged I didn't even recognize them. So It wasn't a pleasant time, as you can imagine.
Yeah, everything's fine now?
Yep. I play tennis at 9 a.m., 3 mornings a week, which is not bad for a 79-year-old guy with a bunch of geezers at the Toronto Lawn Tennis Club. So
yeah.
I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I have tremendous health.
Yeah. Now, you're in the book, you write that your father died of a botched appendectomy. When you were in the hospital, did you think about that and how he died?
Well, because when after what they did to me, I couldn't, think. I was so drugged. But in retrospect, of course, reading the book, I found that rather, I never knew my father. He died when I was 2 of a botched appendectomy in a small hospital in a little town in Saskatchewan. And here, some 70 years later, I almost was sent to heaven by the same medical malpractice.
Yeah. Have you thought of suing St. Michael's?
Sure, I thought about it, and then I talked to my lawyers, and they said, I came out weighing 115 pounds, and they said, you sue the medical profession, they will come out, not only St. Michael's, which is the hospital itself, but the medical profession, and they will have 22-year lawyers there, and you'll have a trial, lasting a couple of months, and you're weighing 115 pounds. Do you think you, could go to the court and face up? And of course, I didn't have any money. I would have one lawyer up against their 22, and it was just simply a no-win situation, so I had to give up about suing.
But this book came out of that, right?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get even in the book, as I explained, about these jerks who almost killed me.
Yeah. Now, in the book, women seem to be a big part of your life, your mother especially, and you've mentioned, we've already talked about your dad dying at a young age. Did you think that the lack of a male influence in your life, that you turned to women for comfort and everything else?
Well, I think so. And as I say in my book, that I'm always amused by, I've always been accused by all my friends and enemies that I like women, and I do, because, of course, my mother, who was the strongest person I've ever met, a widow who, in the middle of the Depression, with four small children, a widow bringing us up, and then two sisters who were older than me, so... I find most men dull compared to women.
Yeah, yeah. In the book, you talk about these various women that you dated. Did you really date Barbara Emile?
Yes.
She denied it, though, right?
Yeah, this is the incredible thing, that we more than dated. We were an item, and I was asked to a dinner party in Vancouver. Old friends of mine, Donna Harvey, she was the editor of the Vancouver Province, so I phoned Barbara, and she flew out, and we went to the party. What I didn't know is that Donna had married a guy called William Klassen, who was a theology professor, and all the other three couples at the party, excuse me, were of the same theology professor, profession linking. And Barbara, trying to show off, started to use bad language in front of them, and to such an extent that they all fled the room and locked themselves in the kitchen, and we didn't even get dinner. And over the years, of course, while I was wandering the world, searching out my 91 countries, and Barbara went looking for another one of her four or five husbands, and of course met and married Conrad Black.
Uh-huh.
So I wrote a column congratulating them, and just in my own playful way, I listed Barbara's many accomplishments, including the time that she emptied an entire room in Vancouver with her colorful language. And she replied with an astonishing column in Maclean's, in which she said she had never dated Mr. Fotheringham, while having admired him from afar, and said she wasn't even in this room, let alone being in Vancouver, where she'd emptied the whole place. And they must have, all the fact checkers at Maclean's must have been on holiday that week, because all they had to do is make a simple phone call to me to see what she was saying were lies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, was traveling the best part of your job?
Well, sure, because I, maybe it was because the little boy from Saskatchewan, that I was always intrigued. My mother, to support us, ran the post office in this little town called Hearne. And it was in the post office was in her house, and sort of inside, she was plugging all the little slots for all the mail slots for all the farmers around. I would see these, and sometimes with travel magazines, and I'd pull them out. And I apparently said to my mother, "I'm going to go there one day." And I did, 91 countries and someone else's money.
Yeah. You're she remarried after your father died, Doug Fotheringham.
Yeah.
Other than sharing a name, how are you most like him?
Well, I'm not like him at all, because he was a bookkeeper. He was very it was the only bachelor in this little town of 26, and her and my mother being the only widow, and so they got married at the start of the war, and because he was a non-fighting soldier, he assumed he'd just be writing checks during the rest of the war, and could he move the family, the army moved him out to a little town, Camp Chilliwack, outside Vancouver. And they assured him that he'd be there, and then once we got there, the army being the army, shipped him overseas, and my mother was a widow again for the rest of the war.
Let's move to the political side of your career and the people that you reported on. The people that you were dazzled by that were really colorful presences in this country politically. I guess Trudeau would be at the top of the list, right?
Oh yeah, sure. As I recount in the book, I covered. Well, I worked in Washington for 5 years, and I covered 12 presidents, and also in our country, 12 prime ministers. And Trudeau was undoubtedly the most spectacular one, with his brain power and his disdain for the press. He thought nothing of the press, and I write in the book about how he actually gave me 3 unconscious compliments, and when I came down, a little pissy-ass kid from Vancouver, no one knew me in Washington, I went to his first press conference, and he said, would the press leave, because he was going to talk to his cabinet, and thinking that no one knew me, I hid behind the counters, behind the drapes, and of course was caught, and the bodyguard came and started to throw me out, and Margaret told me this, that he said, well, what's the fuss going on down there? And she said, well, he's a journalist. And Trudeau said, well, that's funny, he doesn't dress like one. So I took that as a secret compliment. He used to, when he came out of his press conferences, every week he would punch me in the chest as he went by, not speaking to me, which meant to me that he'd read my column that morning and had disturbed him. And then the final compliment is the day that he retired and he drove his white convertible up to the Governor General's place to hand in his papers. And I was standing out front with all the gang, and as he pulled up and braked, just as he stopped, he turned the wheel and ran over my instep. I took that as a secret compliment.
Reading about the people that you covered over the years, and having read your column over the years, gone back to your books and the sort, the politicians say don't seem as colorful as they once were. Is that your sense?
Well, and the reason is because in the old days, for example, I recorded in the book, walking down one day from Parliament Hill, and there were about 8 or 9 of us reporters, and we were walking with Stephen Baker. And so, you know, we chatted, and now there's no way that would happen with television and the internet, and everyone carrying a camera, and you've got hundreds and hundreds of people in the press conferences, in the press gallery. The politicians are afraid to sit down and go and have a beer with you, as we did in those days with the Trudeau and Turner and Chrétien, people like that, because they are so afraid of some unknown with a camera and recording every single thing they say. They can't develop a personal relationship with the press, as in my day, where we could go and have a beer with a senior politician, and they wouldn't have to say that no, this is off the record or this is on the record. They just assumed you were intelligent enough not to spill the beans, you know, to keep the friendship going. That doesn't happen anymore.
Have you spent much time with Stephen Harper?
No, and I haven't missed anything. He is the charm of a dead seal.
Yeah. and it doesn't seem that journalists drink as much as you guys did back then, or am I wrong?
Well, no, I think that's not true, because we didn't make much money in those days, so you just went to the pub and drank some beer, and as did, say, the politicians also didn't make that much money, but you become friends with them. But now then you've got hundreds and hundreds of people in the press gallery, and they all have to work so hard, and they're running around with their tape recorders and their television cameras and all that. So they don't have as much fun as we did.
And I guess one of the people that you had a great deal of fun with was Marjorie Nichols, and I looked it up. She died 20 years ago this year.
Yeah.
And I was too young to have known her work, but I went back and I read her memoir, which is a great book, mark my words.
Yeah.
She was a great writer.
She was the first woman allowed into the press gallery. And she and Jack Webster and I became great friends. We were buddies, and Marjorie was never married, of course, and she just loved to drink with the boys. And the three of us, when we would walk into a room, you know, there would be a hush. That we, especially in the Vancouver days, that we ran the goddamn province, you know, with Webster's bluster on TV and radio, and then TV, and Marjorie and I with her columns. So we had an incredible trio of power, and people were afraid of us. It was disgusting.
And so you were the columnist in The Sun, and the time that you were here in Vancouver, because that's what you're remembered fondly in these parts for.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Did you hate having to leave this part of the world?
Well, it was the simple fact that I was, when Peter Newman became editor of Maclean's, he phoned me and said, I want you to come down to Toronto and talk to me. And he said he wanted me to be the bureau chief in Ottawa. And my wife at the time, she refused to. She hated East, and she wouldn't move. And I said that, well, I can't do that, but I'll write a column for you. And he called in his senior editors, and he said, well, Foss says he can't come east, but he'll write a national column from Vancouver. What do you think? And all of these guys, I knew them, they were good friends, and they said, I love you, Foss, but there's no freaking way you can write a national column from British California out there hiding behind the mountains. And Newman sat there sucking on his pipe and finished, and he said, you're wrong. It may not be a national column. It'll be a Fotheringham column. He said, Alan, file next week. And I filed my first column, and I, being a man of small ambition, I rushed out on Tuesday when I arrived in Vancouver, and I picked up the magazine, and I assumed it would be on, you know, page 3 or 4 or 5 or something. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't there, and I got to page 15, and I thought, shit, it wasn't good enough. And then I went in on the course and got to the back page, which was the most brilliant positioning. 2 years later, both Time and Newsweek put columns on the back page, and now almost any magazine you pick up, they have a column on the back page. And this is the genius of Peter Newman. He really made me.
Yeah. Do you miss the column in Maclean's?
Well, of course I miss it. 27 years, and I get all the time at cocktail parties or on airplanes, and people come up to me and they say, boy, do I ever miss your column in Maclean's. And I say, if you think you missed the column, you should talk to my bank manager.
I also miss the Roy Peterson cartoons. I mean, those were just great.
Oh yeah, we had a great, we were great buddies, and you know, we were so nuanced that I didn't have to tell him or urge him what to, he would just read the column, and he did the columns for first of my four books, I guess.
Uh-huh.
He's a great friend to this day.
Yeah, he's still in Vancouver, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who called you Dr. Foth?
Nick Oftermaar was the hotshot columnist in Montreal, and he started calling me Dr. Foth, and this was after, he was naming me after Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, who was this wild, crazy drug columnist in the States. Drugs such an extent that one politician turned down his invitation for a interview one day, and he went up to his hotel room and set fire to his door. So Oftermaar started calling me Dr. Foth to such an extent that I would walk down the street in Montreal, where I used to go all the time, and complete strangers would yell at me, "Hey, there's Dr. Foth." And the only problem with this is my younger brother, Jack, who couldn't get into UBC because he didn't have French, went across the border to Washington State and worked for 12 years, night school and everything, took his master's and his PhD, and he's now legitimately Dr. John Fotheringham.
Yeah.
And he comes across the border, and he is not amused at me being called Dr. Foth.
Yeah. The when you came out here to get the Bruce Hutchinson Award, I guess it's 9 years ago now, Pete McMartin in The Sun wrote a marvelous piece on you, which you reprint in this book.
Yes.
It's just a... I mean, some of the pieces that, of yours that he quotes back are just wonderful. Who did you read growing up that you emulated or that you admired?
Well, I don't know. Eric Nickel was a humor columnist at the Province.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he... influenced me. He didn't write about politics. He just wrote about, you know, the problems of having breakfast with his wife and that sort of thing. And Pierre Burton I admired as, you know, was the toughest guy in Ottawa. And, you know, I can't really say who influenced me, but whoever it was, it was successful.
Yeah, yeah. Was there anyone that you covered that intimidated you?
No.
No?
No.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Trudeau, would, with his intellect and everything, we once, I used to travel the world with him on, you know, on his plane, and we were in Venice one night, and he was having a private party, and one of the girls in his staff smuggled me in, and he saw me, and he said, "Oh yeah, there's Fotheringham." You know, he said, "You remind me of Cyrano de Bergerac, and you wouldn't know about this." And he started, you know, quoting a long thing out of French, and I said to him, "Oh, Mr. Trudeau, of course I wouldn't understand that because I'm from Western Canada," and we didn't talk for 2 years.
There's a marvelous story in the book about these two checks that Jimmy Pattison sent you. Do you still have them, by the way?
Well, of course. They're in my bank account. And the thing was that Jack Wasserman was the famous columnist on the Vancouver Sun.
Right.
Writing an items column on the front page of the second front. And he... would go every night to all the nightclubs and trendy restaurants in town and write these three-dot items. And one of his star items was always Jimmy Pattison, who I'd never met. he's starting to make his money in the used car dealing. And then Wasserman left for television. And one day I get a phone call from Jimmy Pattison, as I said, I've never met. Mm-hmm. He invited me out for lunch and asked me what I wanted to do with my life. And I was just, you know, I just thought he was bantering away. And I said, oh, I'd like to go to Spain and write the great Canadian novel. I was just throwing away lines.
Mm-hmm.
And the next week I received an envelope from Jimmy Pattison's office with two checks, each for $25,000, one saying promotion and the other research, which I took, you know, as an obvious bribe that he thought I was the new Wasserman, so I'd want to fill my column with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And I put them in the my expense account and did nothing with him, and I've seen Jimmy 4 years and at parties and conventions thing. He never once has mentioned it to him.
You were on Power Play on CTV last week, and Don Martin, you told Don Martin, I should say, that your wife Anne said that you have at least one more book in you. Could it be that great Canadian novel?
Well, I don't know. I'm so exhausted. I'm just setting out. I've just done the promotion of the book before the press gallery in Ottawa last week, and I'm doing two in Vancouver this week. I'm doing 14 across the ground, Calgary, Vancouver, Victoria, etc., mostly in Toronto. So I'm pretty exhausted at in the process of flogging the book, which are my memoirs. So, and as you say, the woman who saved my life in the hospital came in 145 straight days. Maybe she knows me better than me, and she thinks I've got another one.
Yeah, yeah. She just is. In reading the book, and I've talked to Anne via email in arranging this interview.
Yeah.
She just comes off as a saint.
She is. She's a commerce graduate of the University of Toronto, and so she knows her money, and money bores me, and bank accounts, I don't even know what to do. She runs my whole life and all these arrangements with the Dundurn Press, which is publishing the book, and all these contacts, and we're having something like 75 people for the Vancouver launch on the 17th.
Mm-hmm.
And she does all that. She's a goddamn gem.
Yeah. How often do you guys come out to BC?
Well, I've still got two kids there. My number one son tragically died in Korea this summer, which
right.
We come out in the summer, and five grandchildren, and have a great time, Bowen Island and all that stuff.
Yeah. It's been such a pleasure having you on today, Alan. As I've said, I grew up admiring and just enjoying your work, and I really love this book. Congratulations on it. Good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Boy from Nowhere, A Life in 91 Countries. It's published by Dundurn. Alan Fotheringham on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Lunton.